As I said before, let me say it again. Welcome. It is good to see you here. As we take some time to stop and think about God and think about His love, not only for us, but for all people. So last week, we started talking about the trial of Jesus before the Sanhedrin. We talked about the late time, how the verdict seemed to be predetermined. The whole level of corruptness throughout the whole trial. Chief priests going out and looking for people who could bear false witness about Jesus. This is how the trial ends in Mark 40, 60-65. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony these men bring against you?" But Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" "I am," Jesus said. "And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." The high priest tore his clothes. "Why do we need any more witnesses?" he asked. "You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" They all commended him as worthy of death. They began to spit on him. They blindfolded him, struck him with their fists, and said, "Prophesy." And the guards took him and beat him. The reason that the chief priests and the teachers of the law had Jesus put to death was because of the charge of blasphemy. They claimed that Jesus had made a false claim about himself. And blasphemy in their eyes was something worthy and a very probable reason. A very poignant reason for him to be crucified. So here we are, we have all these Jewish leaders wanting to kill Jesus. But remember, we have a problem, and we said this last week. Sure, the religious authorities had found something that they have been able to commend Jesus to immediately be put to death. That charge of blasphemy. But that's Jewish law. The problem is they're under Roman authority. According to Rome, the Jews were not allowed to exercise capital punishment. So what are they to do? I mean, yep, they've come up with that law. They've made that ruling. But it's not the ruling that Rome has given. So they need to go to the Roman authorities, the Roman court, and they need to get Jesus condemned there. But here's the thing. The blasphemy of Yahweh was not considered a crime worthy of death, according to the Romans. So they couldn't use that. So what charge could they bring that would get the Romans to consider a death penalty for Jesus? Today, we look at the charges that the Romans bring against Jesus. And that's treason against Rome. That he claimed to be a king, and that is in direct conflict with Caesar. So in this very, very tiny writing up here, you can see a comparison of the four gospel accounts of the events of the Passion Week. So it starts up here in Palm Sunday, and we can see it's in Matthew and Mark. And then on Monday, what have we got here? Jesus returns. You can see Matthew, Mark, Luke. And as we go down, you can see more and more of the gospels pick up on this idea. Judas betrays Jesus is in 3. The Last Supper, the praying in the garden, the arrest, the trial before the religious leaders. And then it gets to this point, the trial before Pilate. Now, I want to highlight something here, though. Luke's gospel has it slightly different from Mark. And it's not conflict, it's just interesting. See, Jesus is brought to Pilate, and Pilate realizes that actually he's not the one who should be making the call. So he sends him to Herod. Herod was in charge of the area of Galilee, so it was Herod's jurisdiction. But Herod's a smart man. He knows that this is a political minefield. So he works out a way to toss him back to Pilate. It's actually interesting because Pilate and Herod apparently had these issues. They didn't really like each other. And this sort of collaboration and, you know, it's an interesting way of looking at it. But as I was studying this, I realized something, that Pilate isn't necessarily a bad person. Sometimes we read the Gospels and we're very quick to assign who is the bad guy in the story. I want to present to you today that Pilate is a man who takes simply justice seriously. It's highlighted in Luke's difference. It's highlighted in the Gospels because he realizes that Jesus is innocent of the charges brought against him. He's someone who takes justice seriously. That's why he wants to give it to Herod. Not to pass the buck, but because it's meant to be Herod's call. Pilate did, I think, a lot of things to see that Jesus wasn't actually killed. I mean, the point of the scourging was to satisfy the leaders. You know what a scourging is, right? Where he gets whipped, but it's not a regular whip. It's a whip, and at the end is twisted bone hooks and sharp rocks. The idea of a scourging was it was to rip the flesh off your back. Pilate didn't do it because, hey, he likes whips. He did it to appease the religious leaders. I've punished this guy. Surely that's enough. But here's something you don't pick up. Do you know Pilate and the Jews had a history together? Pilate had made as one writer suggests, some poor decisions in the past. Pilate is someone who is also incredibly worried about losing his position. Perhaps he was simply one bad choice away from losing his head. Pilate did all he could to make sure the law was upheld, but in the end, it seemed that it was more important to appease the Jewish leaders and let them carry out their horrible plot to murder Jesus. See, Pilate had two responsibilities, two duties that must be fulfilled, two duties that have come from Tiberius Caesar himself. Tiberius Caesar wanted to have peace in the empire. He didn't want conflicts. And he wanted the governors to bring in the revenue of taxes. A peaceful populace is more likely to pay taxes without a struggle. So Rome allowed the freedom of worship of various countries that they had conquered. Meanwhile, the Roman citizens not only worshipped the Roman god, but they also worshipped the emperor himself. So this is where Pilate and the Jews have a little bit of history. See, Pilate had done some things that the Jews considered to be very bad. Pilate had done a few things that had broken the peace and incited rebellion against Rome among the Jews. The life of Pilate is a very interesting study. See, when Pilate first moved into Jerusalem, he brought an army. They carried these big standards. You know what a standard is? It's a battle flag, right? The battle flag, so you know, oh, over there, that's Ali's troops over there, and over here we got Barbie's troops. I can see these armies, right? But on these standards were the picture of the emperor. He's walking into the city of Jerusalem carrying a banner of the emperor. The Jews knew what that was about. That's emperor worship. Didn't sit right with them. So when Pilate moves into his house, what's the first thing he does? He puts up big shields on the wall with the emperor's name and likeness engraved on them. That didn't sit well with the Jews. Then the Jews got really worked up, and there was a few, this is the official term, brouhahas, where to squash the riot, Pilate sent in troops with clubs to knock the head off the rebellion. These incidences, these unrests had upset Caesar. He had been remanded by the emperor. His career could not endure another failure, especially one involving a political uprising. Pilate and the Jews had history. Pilate wants to uphold the laws as they are written. I think it's interesting in verses 6 to 10 that Pilate goes, okay, these religious leaders have it out for Jesus. What about the crowd? And he tries to get the public opinion on his side. That's what they're talking about here when it was custom at the festival to release a prisoner that the people requested. So Pilate here is trying to encourage people, hey, if you think this Jesus is innocent, say so now as a crowd so I can squash these religious leaders. So I know that you out there are not going to revolt against me. That didn't work. For this reason, the religious leaders are against Pilate. The Jews are against Pilate if he makes a wrong decision here. And for this reason, I think Pilate is forced to try Jesus on a trumped-up charge. In other Gospels, it talks about the fact that Jesus was innocent. He hadn't done anything worthy of death. And Pilate washes his hands of any guilt, saying, this is on the Jewish people. But we can't ignore that Pilate decided to appease the Jews and their demands concerning Jesus, even if it meant putting an innocent man to death. Herod was trying hard to keep the peace. Pilate was trying hard to keep the peace. But there was only one thing that would happen. The other interesting thing within this passage is that the charges that the Jews bring against Jesus of blasphemy are not the charges that the Roman Empire will acknowledge. See, Jesus said that he was the Son of God, the Messiah. The sedition that Jesus was trying to incite a riot among the religious leaders and the Jewish people. Pilate doesn't really care about the ins and outs of the Jewish faith political nonsense. One could even argue that Pilate didn't really care for Jewish law. Instead, Jesus was tried by Pilate on one question. Are you the king of the Jews? The Sanhedrin thought that Jesus was worthy of death. But that charge and that belief had no standing under Rome. So how do they do it? They change the charge. This Jesus here, he is planning to overthrow the Roman government. It's not like it was a hidden fact that Jesus believed himself to be the King of the Jews. I mean, a few days ago, we had him riding into town on a donkey like a king, and people worshiping him like a king. I think the idea here that Jesus coming in with like a king would have even been noticed by the Roman citizens. And this claim of kingship was possible a threat to Roman occupation. And again, we come back to this point of a claim of Jesus' kingship might cause the people to unite and cause a riot or a flat-out war between the Jews and the Romans. Actually, that war is coming soon. Not soon here, but in the story, soon then. There's a great big war between the Jews and the Romans. But did you notice that when the Romans, when they get a hold of him, that they refer to him as not the Messiah, not the Son of God, but refer to him as King of the Jews? When they mock him in a king's outfit. They put a purple robe around him that signifies royalty. They decided that every good king needs to wear a crown. So they had someone run out to Bunnings, grab a thorn bush, and craft a crown of thorns to put on his head. One gospel even talks about how they found a reed, and they put it in his hands like a king wielding a scepter. And they began to beat him, mock him, hit him, spit on him. They would mockingly bow down before him. When we come to this, I often feel like we can't deal with just exactly how cruel and painful this was. So, there's a movie director, Quentin Tarantino. I don't believe I'm ever going to, I didn't think that. Anyway, Quentin Tarantino does these movies that are full of violence and full of blood. And in one particular movie, he had to take that whole series of scenes and turn it into black and white. And one film student or film critic asked him, "Hey, why did you do this?" And he said, "Because the American conscience cannot handle that amount of blood." And I think that's a reflection here, that we have this sort of dulled down version of how much this sucks. I mean, you talk about the crown of thorns, and Do you think about, you know, the little prick when you accidentally touch the wrong one? Or do you think about what it would be like to have the thorns literally pushed in so deep that they would have likely gone into his scalp? Into his scalp so much that these thorns is what is holding that crown on Jesus' head. And I want to ask you a question. In this particular moment, do you think that Jesus looks like the Messiah, the chosen one of God? Does Jesus really look like the King of the Jews? See, one writer shared this, that this mocking is actually very powerful, for it is in the mocking of Jesus that he is really glorified. They point out that the crown of thorn illustrates that though he was king over all the universe, he was willing to descend from his throne and come and be born of flesh and live among us, his creation, as one of us. Likewise, the purple robe, though the color of royalty, showed a king who was willing to come down into the heat of the battle and to be wounded. The reed put in his hands was this imagery that he had laid down all of his powers and all of his rights in order to come and dwell with humanity. All the things that are happening here is because of the glory of God. God made flesh. And these are the things that bring him worthy of praise. It seems like Jesus isn't king here because of how he's being mocked. But the truth is that he is a king more powerful than we can possibly understand. Last week we started talking about Advent, a time when we focus ourselves on the nativity of Jesus. A time of preparation for not what has been, but what is still to come. See, the original idea of Advent was that as Christians, that we would get together at this time and we would celebrate the birth of Christ. But not only that, we would look forward to the day when the King comes truly and powerfully as King. That's what the 6th century Christians believed. The second coming of Christ, that is what we're celebrating in Advent. The second coming of Christ, where he comes, as he said, as on clouds, as the judge of the world. It's a weird thing to be talking about the death of Jesus at a time when we want to focus on his birth. But there's method in my madness. See, we need both. We need his birth, because that shows that he has come to earth in human flesh. And we need his death, because it pays the price of our sins. And we need his resurrection, because it sets us up for the next bit, and that is the return of Jesus. And much like the people who were looking forward to the first coming of the Messiah, those who eagerly went to the temple and prayed, those who knew that this world is not as it should be. War and greed, distress and evil, it all seems to creep around. Did you know that the Bible doesn't tell us to remember Jesus' birth? It doesn't say December 25th, you should have a Christmas celebration. But it does call us to remember his death and his resurrection because of the way it changes our relationship with God. And it also calls us to remember that he is to come again. A few weeks ago, we looked at it, right? That we should always be prepared and on the lookout. But when we think about the second coming, we should be as excited as that kid opening the Christmas present that they really wanted. But we also need to be aware that this excitement needs to be held in fine balance with reality. There's the old saying, don't be so heavenly focused that you're no use on earth. In Mark 13, Jesus tells us his coming back will be like a man going away. He leaves his house, he puts his servants in charge, each with their assigned tasks, and tells one to keep watch at the door. In other words, we're to keep an eye out while still working to develop his kingdom. In Matthew's Great Commission, we're told to take the message to the end of the earth. Jesus tells us in the Lord's Prayer that when we are to pray, we are to pray that God's kingdom be made on earth as it is in heaven. Yes, we get into the Christmas mood. We celebrate his birth. But we're still also meant to get excited that he will return. And while we'll wait, we are to take what God has given us, his love, his compassion. And do you know what we are to do with it? Give it to others. Give it to others. So in a moment, we're going to have the Lord's Supper, communion. And it's a symbol that we take to remind us that we are tied into his death. So as we partake in communion during this Advent time, our hope is on the return of Jesus. And we focus on where it all started, his death and resurrection. Richard?